time for our morning conversation today, and my guest is Dr. Shari Parker. Dr. Shari Parker is a woman living with albinism, but we're going to also talk about her life as a doctor. She completed her Bachelor of Medicine, Bachelor of Surgery in 1999, graduating with honours. She completed her Fellowship in Rehabilitation Medicine in 2007, being awarded the Basjerman Prize for the best performance in the Fellowship's clinical examination in Australasia. She's currently a Staff Specialist and Deputy Director of Rehabilitation Medicine at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, where she heads up the mobile rehabilitation team. She's also Chair of Rehabilitation Medicine at St Vincent's Private Hospital, heading up the rehabilitation area in the award-winning Extended Care Program. She's a conjoint lecturer at the University of New South Wales and a senior conjoint lecturer at the University of Notre Dame. On top of that, she has a husband and three young children, and is clearly a woman on a mission to get the most out of life. Shari Parker, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Robin. Absolute pleasure.
That's a decent CV you have there.
You don't realise how busy you are until it's read out like that. So no wonder I'm exhausted all the time.
There you go. Now, let's start with the journey to medicine first. Why medicine?
Well, when I was going through school, I had a number of different careers that I was thinking about doing. I thought it would be fun to be a vet. I loved animals. And then I thought, no, I actually find the weather really interesting. We've had some interesting weather in Sydney recently, so I thought I'd become a meteorologist, and then I thought maybe a librarian. I love reading. And then in year eight science, we were doing biology, and we went to dissecting bull's eyes, and I'm sure many of your listeners will remember back to high school science and doing those dissections. And I just found it absolutely fascinating, possibly because of my own vision-related issues, but from that point on, I just couldn't get enough of anything related to the human body and how the human body worked. And I became a voracious reader and studier of everything related to the human body and to human health, and decided that I would study medicine. And obviously, having a very significant vision impairment, there were a few teachers who kind of took me aside and tried to talk a bit of sense into me, saying, you're legally blind, you actually can't be a doctor. But perhaps a bit of a stubborn person, I doggedly went on and studied hard and got into medicine at the University of New South Wales, where I started almost 20 years ago.
Wow, okay, that's quite a journey. I also understand you had some difficulty getting the accreditation at the end. Once you'd actually done all your study, there was still some view that because of your vision impairment, you wouldn't be able to practice.
Mm. Yeah, it was quite a catastrophic time in my life. I was coming up to the final end of year six medical exams, and had been studying for 7 years and had done honours and progressed well. And it came to the point where we were starting to apply for accreditation with the New South Wales Medical Board. And as part of that, I had obviously always declared my vision issues. And because it was coming to internship, I then had to go a little bit further and get a form signed off by an ophthalmologist to agree that I could go about doing that. I hadn't seen an ophthalmologist for several years, so I looked up in the white pages with my magnifying glass and found one, and my GP referred me along to this lady who, at the end of assessing me, said, "You can't be a doctor. I'm not going to sign this form." And I'm there 7 years after studying medicine, with my eyes dilated, sitting on the footpath, thinking, "What's the last 7 years been for?" So I went and had a talk to the Dean of Medicine, who is an absolutely lovely man, who made an appointment for me to see a retinal specialist, who understood that function is not necessarily related to impairment. There is a relationship, but what you can see and what you can do from a functional perspective, there are many other factors that come into play, your personal factors, your environmental factors, which mean that, even though you can just read the top line on the chart, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to have particular functional implications. So and he'd obviously seen that, I'd gone through medicine and had passed all my studies and clinical placements and so on and so forth. And so he was happy to sign off the form, and I did have a hearing with the medical board, which put two conditions on my registration. The first is that I will only undertake procedures within the limits of my visual ability, and the medical board left it, pretty much left that to me with the knowledge that I know my vision better than anyone else, and I won't undertake anything where I'm potentially going to put my patients at risk. And so that's how it's been for the last 11 years, and there haven't been any major issues.
Which would seem to be a no-brainer. Of course you're not going to put someone else at risk, and you expose then yourself to the risk of being sued and so on, so why would you do that? Mm. I'm interested to understand how your fellow students, when you first started studying, how they coped with you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm quite a different person today from what I was when I started studying medicine 20 years ago. These days I'm very upfront and open, and will tell anyone who's willing to listen about albinism and about my vision impairment. Back then, I perhaps wasn't so far along in my journey, and I didn't speak about it openly with my fellow peers. I would use my handheld monocular spyglass, as I affectionately called it, to read the board, and I'd use my handheld magnifying glass, but there wasn't a lot of... It didn't often come up with the other students, and I know when I first wrote an article about having albinism a couple of years after I graduated, I had a deluge of emails and phone calls from my fellow students who actually said, "We never knew that you were legally blind." Mm. One of them thought that my handheld monocular was in fact a little camera, and I was taking photos of the screen. And these are the doctors of tomorrow. It just goes to show that it's not a lot of knowledge about albinism in the qualified or the studying doctors.
Well, I was actually going to say, was there a period during your study when you were actually studying albinism?
Albinism doesn't come up certainly when I went through, didn't come up as a specific topic. It was perhaps mentioned briefly in genetics as an example of an autosomal recessive condition. It was mentioned in passing in physiology related to the molecular pathways that lead to the formation of melanin. So it was mentioned in passing there. And the third point where it was mentioned was a line in a textbook to do with nystagmus, which is the side-to-side eye movement, which said that pendulum nystagmus can be related to albinism. That was pretty much it.
And no, it's interesting none of your lecturers decided perhaps to ask you if you'd like to speak to your fellow students about it.
No, it didn't come up whatsoever throughout the medical degree. Since then, I'm doing lecturing at the universities. So now if I had to give a lecture, 2-hour lecture to 600 medical students on back pain about a month ago, and I took the opportunity 10 minutes at the start to say, look, if you ask me any questions, if you put your arms up, I'm not going to be able to see you, and this is why I'm going to give you 10 minutes about albinism, because you're not going to hear it at any other point in your medical degree. So hopefully those 600 medical students will... now know a little bit more.
Now, is that really, I guess, one of the battles that people with albinism face, that because it's not, it's unfortunately got a dreadful stereotype thanks to Hollywood, but also I'm quite shocked to hear that really your lecturers didn't take advantage of the fact that you were a student there to talk about the condition more. Is that one of the things that people living with albinism battle, I guess, that there's a lot of ignorance about the condition?
Yeah, ignorance not only amongst the general population but also amongst the medical fraternity. I'm the secretary of the Albinism Fellowship of Australia, so I hear a lot about what is said to parents of kids with albinism and adults with albinism by their well-meaning general practitioners, and it's they're not trying to be unpleasant or unkind, it's just purely lack of knowledge. You know, so I was asked only a couple of weeks ago, so were you born with albinism? And does it affect one eye or both eyes? And, you know, other GPs will ask, will say, you don't have albinism because you don't have red eyes, which is a myth, in fact.
Explain that myth, because it has, I think Hollywood's particularly exploited that myth. And I realise we haven't, in fact, explained albinism, and I might get you to just very briefly explain it.
Albinism, or your listeners may think of albinos, we don't like the term so much, but albinism, or a person with albinism, it's caused by the lack of the pigment or the colouring called melanin, which is the main pigment which gives us colouring to our hair and to our skin. So a person with albinism has got a range of hair colour. Some will be that snowy white, and some will have a little bit more colour, might be sort of more in the yellow or golden kind of appearance. So very fair hair, white skin, milky skin, and sometimes with a few moles and things, but generally white hair, white skin. And because that melanin is important for the normal development of the eye pathways when the baby's in utero, people with albinism have also got a very significant vision impairment. 80% of us are in the regions of being legally blind, and that relates to the macula, which is the part of the eye that gives us fine vision, that's poorly developed. Also, the normal nerves that cross in the brain and give us binocular vision, that doesn't happen so much in albinism, so we have very poor depth perception. We're also extremely photophobic, which means that the light is very, very unpleasant and very painful and can lead to a complete loss of vision if we go out into the bright light, as well as astigmatism or a misshapen eyeball, and also refractive errors, so either being long-sighted or short-sighted. And a combination of all those issues is what results in the vision impairment in albinism.
And so this myth of the red eye, where does that come from?
So where that comes from, normally if you shine a light in someone's eye, a bit of anatomy. Firstly, you've got the pupil, which is the black bit, which is in fact just a hole that sends light through to the back of the eye. You've then got the iris, which is the coloured bit around the pupil. And in albinism, that tends to be range from being sort of a violet colour through to a light blue through to a darker blue. So, Robin, if I shone a light in your eye, the light will go through the pupil into the back of the eye, into the retina, and would largely be absorbed in the retina. In a person with albinism, because that iris is generally very light, it doesn't have very much pigment, the light not only goes through the pupil, also in through the iris, so there's a bombardment of light that goes into the eyeball. And then because we don't have the pigment in the back of the eye, it's not absorbed, it's in fact reflected back and scatters back not only through the pupil, but also through the iris as well. But in general light, people with albinism, you'll never see a red-eyed person with albinism. In a bright light, sudden bright lighting, and obviously with flash photography, you will get that glowing red eyes, and it will be more exaggerated than in the normal person because it's not only coming back through the pupil, it's also coming back through the iris or the coloured part of the eye as well, and that's what they call transillumination.
Okay. Is it is the eyesight, the effects on eyesight, the hardest thing to live with albinism, or is it in fact the stigma around the condition, or is it the sun?
Probably a combination of the three. The vision issues do make life harder from some perspectives. You know, most of us can't drive, and we do suffer a lot from visual fatigue. Although we can often read a normal kind of text, our eyes will get really tired at the end of the day, and we can kind of get a sensory overload and just have whole brain kind of fatigue at the end of the day. And then, so there are discrimination issues related both to the vision impairment as well as to appearing different, and especially in kids in primary school, kids will pick on the kid that looks different, whether that be the tall kid, the short kid, the kid who's a little bit overweight, or the kid who comes from a different background, or the kid with albinism. And obviously, we're potentially a target as kids because of the nature of what children are like and you know, tease other kids because they appear different.
Did you have that experience?
I did to some degree, and thankfully, perhaps because I had a close group of friends, I had an older sister who could back me up. Thankfully, it didn't affect me too much, but I know that it can be really tough when you're not only dealing with having difficulty seeing but also being teased because you look different. It can be really tough on kids.
Mm. Now, you've got three children yourselves. Do any of them live with albinism?
No, they're all very fair, but none of them have albinism, and that's how the condition is inherited. It's what, as I mentioned before, it's an autosomal recessive condition, which means that you've got to have two copies of the gene, a double dose of the gene, if you like, in order to show the condition. So neither my parents have albinism, but both of them would carry a gene for albinism. And then me getting a double dose of the gene means that I have albinism. I've also got an older sibling. I've got two older siblings, in fact, one of whom has albinism and the other who doesn't. So my kids, all of them will have one albinism gene, but because they don't have that second one, they don't show the condition. And it's interesting to note that about 1 in 70 people in the general community actually carries a gene for albinism. So,
which is quite a lot, because I understand it's about 1,000 people, 1,000 babies a year are born with albinism?
Yeah, in Australia there are probably around, based on our current population, probably about 1,200 people with albinism in Australia, so it's about 1 in 17,000.
And yet 1 in 70 of us carry the gene.
Carry the gene.
It is to do with the connection of the two.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so then does that mean, is there a way to genetically test for that, should someone want to know one way or the other?
Yeah, it is possible, Robin. But generally it's not done because albinism is one of the more benign genetic conditions. It doesn't affect intelligence, it doesn't affect lifespan if you're living in a first world country. So although it can be done, it's not generally done.
Okay. One of the things I loved in you were talking about something I read, things that are good about albinism, and one of the things I love was that you have beautiful skin.
Yeah, we don't go out in the sun, so we don't get that the horrendous sun exposure.
Well, it's interesting because that's become quite de rigueur now. You know, you've sort of got stars like Cate Blanchett and the redhead whose name's now escaped me, Nicole Kidman.
Yes, who
sort of use whitening products.
It's fascinating, isn't it? How fashions change and
I think
there are still quite a few people who like the tanning salons and like to apply fake tans and things, but it's fascinating.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, we are all asked to get a good 10 minutes of sun a day for our vitamin D. So is there an issue with for people with albinism with vitamin D?
Interestingly, there's not been anything written about albinism and vitamin D. I'm actually looking to work with another doctor who has albinism who lives over in the States. I know of 4 doctors with albinism and 2 medical students with albinism, so we're a fairly unique club. But one of the doctors that I do know is an endocrinologist over in the States, and we're looking to possibly do some research into vitamin D levels in people with albinism. By rights, because we are very fair, we should absorb the vitamin D more effectively than a darker-skinned person. But because we tend to avoid the sunlight, because when we do go out, we're covered up or slathered in sunscreen, anecdotally, most people with albinism that I know who've had their vitamin D levels checked are low. And in fact, when I had my levels checked, it was 21, which is less than half of what it should normally be.
Mm, okay. Now, we've talked a little bit about the psychosocial aspects. I'm interested to understand are involved with the Albinism Fellowship and clearly keen to promote a much more positive view than Hollywood has given us.
Absolutely.
How big is that barrier, do you feel? Hollywood's a big juggernaut to counter, I guess.
I think that the reason why albinism is so poorly understood in the community is firstly because it's pretty rare. Most people won't meet another person with albinism, so they won't know the fundamentals. And secondly, because we do have a bad rap from Hollywood, with Silas, who was...
You mean you're not evil murderers?
No, we are not evil murderers. We don't have any special powers, unfortunately. It would be nice if we did sometimes. We're just normal people who happen to have very fair hair, very fair skin, and a vision impairment.
Is there an issue, I guess, particularly at the level of children, with depression?
Again, it hasn't been formally investigated. But if you think about a kid who may be terribly teased or bullied in childhood, and in those formative years when they're developing their sense of self, that's affected by bullying, I think it could be an issue, and I think it's something to possibly look into. Like with any health condition or any disability, if you like, having that and having to deal with life with additional challenges, I think does put people at risk of having psychological issues, and certainly in the area that I work in disability management, in rehabilitation medicine, certainly people with physical disabilities are at a high risk of affective conditions such as depression.
Mm. Now, you have chosen to specialise in rehabilitation. What drove that?
Firstly, it was an area that meant that vision wasn't such a barrier. And secondly, I guess because I've been living with a disability all of my life, you know, I'm in probably a unique position to be able to help my patients to manage their disabilities better. Perhaps I've got an extra special empathy with patients for dealing with other issues.
That's your special power, perhaps.
Oh, I don't know. We'll work on it, Robin.
What would you like, what key messages, I guess, do you want people to take away from this interview about albinism?
Firstly, that we're not evil freaks. We're just normal people who have got a vision impairment. We don't all dye our hair. We're not all from Sweden. We don't all have red eyes. We're just normal people who have differences like everyone in society.
Is that actually quite common? People think you're from Sweden.
Oh, absolutely. Or, you know, people pay thousands of dollars to get your hair colour. And some of the other misconceptions are that, you know, maybe if you just get glasses, you can see a bit better. And depends where you are in your day, whether you want to sit down and explain about the anatomy of the eye and that it's in fact a problem with the macula, or just to say smile and nod.
Yes, yeah. Yes, there is that. I think that's the other thing for me from you, much more than your albinism, is actually the message you send to people with vision loss about what's achievable, having gone through your medical degree. And I guess as a final question, I just wanted to ask you, where did that come from? Was that your parents really just saying, well, anything's possible?
I think my parents certainly had a key role in not holding me back. You know, when I was a kid, if I wanted to climb a tree and hopefully not fall out of it too often, but that's fine. If I wanted to ride a bike, I might fall off a bit more often. But they never really held me back. They helped to facilitate what I wanted to do. And, you know, as I grew older, I realised that there were some things that I couldn't do, and I had to come to terms with the fact that I'd never be able to drive and things like that. But parents allowing their kids to make mistakes, I think, is really important, but also to give them the skills and the knowledge about their health problems to be able to get on and to live as independent people.
Look, Shari, it's been wonderful to speak with you today. Thank you for your time. And that's Dr. Shari Parker. For more information, you can go to the Albinism Fellowship of Australia, www.albinismaustralia.org. And that's our morning conversation for today.